And you've already been given the outline of the course, so I'm not going to waste time and write it again. Essentially, we'll just cover up to Cauchy's theorem and its application in evaluating contour integral. So I'm a physicist, not a mathematician, so many of your mathematical-minded questions will go unanswered in this course. As I said, this is not supposed to be an in-depth course, but kind of the reminder of some of the techniques that we think that you'll need for the rest of the year. So please interrupt. Hopefully, sometimes the interruptions are fruitful because even if I can't answer your question, somebody else in the audience can. And it happens quite a bit. So just So for most of you, this is a review course because you've already seen most of it before. But even then, every year, there's some lively discussions on some of the topics. So, okay, as you all know, so we won't dwell too much on the history of complex numbers, but it was apparently introduced by some guy called Rolando Cardano. So Cardano in the 16th century was trying to solve the algebraic equation, quadratic equation. For the value of the coefficient for this value. And as you all know from the, so the general solution to this equation So for b squared less than 4ac, you have to introduce the notion of the square root of a negative number. So in modern terms, you have to introduce, the idea of the imaginary unit. So probably that's not this. You guys can't really see this. So. So this kind of begs the question that if you are going to solve, say, more general equations like the cubic, the quartic, or whatever polynomial equation, do you have to introduce more generalized notions of like, what about the cube root of minus one or something similar, right? And we know from the fundamental theorem of algebra that the introduction of complex numbers is enough. And that's because the fundamental theorem of algebra tells us that, any polynomial equation, polynomial can be written as a product of linear parts where the roots are given by, in general, complex numbers, right? So this idea is an amazingly powerful idea. It allows us to solve, polynomial equations of arbitrary power, and that's just the beginning of it, right? It's just, when you actually go to the realm of complex functions and complex analysis, whole new vistas open up. And not only that, you also have, a lot of the field of complex geometry is even more exotic and interesting. So I just wanted to kind of, mention a few things about, a few basic things about complex numbers from mathematics. Analysis is almost impossible to do. Sorry, let me turn off my phone. Nobody calls me, but just in case. Well, my vet's office, my cat's doctor calls me sometimes in the morning. So for example, we all know that, you know, this, the series expansion of this function, what is it? 1 minus x squared, right? You know, this, so this only makes sense for x. So the series expansion only makes sense for value of the modulus of x less than 1. And in real analysis, it's hard to see why. But when you go to complex, when you extend this function to the complex plane, you find that at the value of plus I and minus I, you know, this function has simple poles, singularities, and Taylor's expansion, which is what the right side is, Taylor series only converges in a circle. So what we see on the right hand side is a convergence, is the Taylor series around the origin, and this, you know, so this is only valid inside this disk, this open disk, and that's because there are singularities bounding this disk on the imaginary axis. So this is something that is not obvious from just the real expansion of this function. So this is just a tiny little thing. So just kind of wanted to mention tangentially, and also as a segue to physics, is that you can then ask, you know, does this function not exist in the rest of the complex plane? The answer to that is it does, and there's something called analytic continuation, where you can actually, extend this function to all of the complex plane except at points where it becomes singular. And so this has an application has a kind of a similar application in GR, which I'll mention, you know, in a few minutes. Okay, so in physics, you know, one of the fundamental equations in quantum mechanics is Schrodinger's equation, right? And Schrodinger's equation has I in it. And the wave function is a complex, in general, a complex, it's a complex function, right? So it turns out that complex numbers are woven into the fabric of reality. For example, if you want to describe the behavior of charge particles, it turns out that the way to do it in quantum mechanics is to take complex conjugate of the field or the operator that creates the charge particle. And then also, Schrodinger's equation has the same form as the heat equation. If the Schrodinger's equation didn't have the I or stuff like, if it was a real equation, it would look just like the heat equation. Second derivative in space, first derivative in time, right? And we know that the heat equation has, it's not a reversible, time reversible equation. Because, you know, it's first order in time. So, you know, if you put t to minus t, you don't get the same equation back. But if you look at the Schrodinger equation, what you can see is that it's actually time reversible as long as you also do a complex conjugation. So we know that the microscopic physics of our world, it's reversible. And that's very intimately, so if you look at elementary processes, which involves just a few particles, if you run the film backwards, it looks the same, you know, that's described by roughly the same equations. So Schrodinger equation, because of the fact that it's complex, it's time reversible. And the fact that you also have to do a complex conjugation there, it's related to the fact that, you know, at least I think so, to the fact that, you know, when positive particles go backward in time, they actually become negative particles and vice versa. But quantum mechanics is just kind of the non-relativistic approximation of quantum field theory. And the foundational issues of quantum field theory is actually, there's a lot of complex analysis hidden there. So this is basically, you know, if you ever go into the extremely rarefied field of foundations of quantum field theory, you'll see that, that analytical aspects of fields are extremely, you know, yes, Saad.
Can you not just solve the Schrodinger equation as two coupled partial differential equations because the complex plane is two coupled?
Yeah, sure, you can.
So then how does the existence, the fact that the Schrodinger equation is complex, result in complex numbers being woven naturally?
So I think the better way of looking at it is to look at the linear combinations of, for example, if you take, so linear combination of wave functions. So if you have, you know, Schrodinger's equation is linear, and because it's, and if you look at all the solutions which have the same boundary conditions, you know, any linear combination of them will also be a solution to Schrodinger's equation, right? And there will be, if you restrict your, for example, if you restrict your the coefficients that the linear combination is taken over to be real, then you're actually going to miss out on a lot of the rich phenomena, such as interference and things like that. And then, the fact that, then when you take the probability, when you want to measure the probability, you have to take the square, the complex conjugate of these guys, right? And that gives rise to the interference patterns that we see. And the fact that you took a linear combination over the complex numbers actually makes a difference. You know, it's an observable thing, right? Which you couldn't have done by using. I'm not exactly answering, you're not answering your question exactly, because I don't know how to formulate it mathematically. But I think it's similar to saying that, Cauchy-Riemann equations, right? You can formulate them in terms of U's and V's, right? The real and the imaginary part. But that's the whole thing, is that, they're all related, but they're related in a very special way, connected to complex differentiability. So Schrodinger equation will be something similar, so. So classical gravity, and this is something that is not quite advertised, is also uses complex numbers in an essential way. And the way, when Neil teaches his course on GR, you'll see that, one of the most famous solutions of Einstein's equations is the Schwarzschild solution. It's Schwarzschild, not Schwarzschild. it's the R is German, so I can't really do that. But maybe do you speak German?
No.
Okay. But we do have other any German speaking person in the class?
I thought it was Schwarzschild.
Schwarzschild? I would say Schwarzschild. Black. Shield is shield. It's a shield, right? It's not a child. It's a black shield. Anyway, the guy died in, in the First World War. You had a question? Oh, okay. but the idea, when the Schwarzschild solution was first discovered, it only describes part of the space-time that describes a spherically symmetric solution. So, the Schwarzschild solution breaks down at what we now call the horizon. So what is inside the horizon? Later people found out a coordinate transformation that allows you to look inside the horizon. And so for all solutions of any solution of Einstein's equation, you first set out some, coordinate system and you find the solution. But then if you want to extend it to, there's a unique maximal analytic extension of that solution, and that maximum analytic extension is actually kind of related to the underlying, you know, analytic properties of the coordinate functions. And then Roger Penrose, extremely imaginative guy, you know, he introduced a way of thinking of GR in terms of twisters, I think back in the 60s, maybe, yeah. And that twisters program also uses, you know, I think it uses the quaternions, or, you know, in an essential way, and also the idea of complex numbers. And you know, the idea of twisters have just resurfaced in physics in many, many different ways. Most recently, in terms of trying to solve quantum field theory exactly, you know, Freddy Cattasso here is using a lot of those techniques, twister techniques, to work on, you know, exact solutions of quantum field theories, things like that. And then last but not least is complex numbers are used in an essential way in string theory. So in string theory, what you, the at least, you know, people are now trying to reformulate it, but in the original formulation of string theory, it's a sum over Riemann surfaces. A string propagating in space-time, you can Euclideanize the space-time, and it looks like a tube. And the tube can, it can be mapped into a sphere. And then, so it's something like this. So this is essentially a tube, like a sphere with two punctures. And then the one loop diagram is something like this. So this is essentially a torus with two punctures. And then so on and so forth. So this is just the, you know, self-interaction diagram of a particle. And it turns out that string theory is a sum over these spaces. And these spaces are called Riemann surfaces. And they encode, they are the most primitive and basic examples of what is known as complex manifolds. So this takes us to the realm of complex geometry, you know, which is a completely distinct, it's a generalization of the idea of Riemannian geometry. You know, when you, if you study Riemannian complex geometry, you'll see that again, it cannot be reduced to Riemannian geometry, you know, the way that, you know, Saad was trying to do for quantum mechanics, because you'll see that two geometries can be, you know, diffeomorphic to each other as real manifolds, but they may not be diffeomorphic to each other as complex manifolds. So the partition function of string theory is a sum over the complex structures of these spaces. And then string theory, as you know, famously lives in 10 dimensions, or infamously, as I should say. And so to get four-dimensional physics out, you have to compactify six of the dimension. And it turns out those six dimensions, at least for the simplest kind of semi-realistic real-world physics to appear from them, have to be what are known as Calabi-Yau manifolds. And these Calabi-Yau manifolds are very interesting class of complex geometries. And these Calabi-Yau manifolds come with holes and all kinds of, you know, interesting data that you can deform. So, and these deformations are, can be thought about as the deformation of the complex, the complex structure of that geometry. But what's interesting is that these deformations in four dimensional, from the four dimensional point of view, should appear to us as massless fields. We don't see these massless fields, and that's an outstanding problem in string theory. But in principle, we could see these massless fields. So in some sense, you know, these massless scalar fields that string theory predicts, which in principle could be observable, are just a manifestation of the complex geometry of the underlying manifold. Okay. And in recent years, people are trying to generalize even that notion of complex geometry. These are called generalized complex structures or generalized complex. Anyway, I'm just kind of telling you that complex numbers and complex analysis and this is very much an active field, you know, even after so many years. Okay, so, and I think you can probably tell me what's your favorite application of complex numbers, or tell the others. Yes. Calculating what?
Integrals.
Integrals, yes, that's a good application, yes. Anybody else want? It can be very simple, like, I love the Euler formula. It could be as simple as that, you know?
Fourier analysis?
Fourier analysis, yes, great. Makes it a lot more elegant. Anybody else? Yes.
I think you can get parametric from Schwarzschild metric from a complex transformation.
I didn't know that. Nice.
Which metric, sorry?
Kerr.
Kerr.
So the rotating black hole. Anybody else? Yes.
I just like how much more elegant complex linear algebra is than real linear algebra.
Right, exactly. Anybody else? I remember I was in Dhaka University studying for a complex analysis course, and I was so much into it. It was so beautiful. First time in my life that I found mathematics beautiful. And I was studying for the exam, and I looked up, and through the curtains in the room, I could see the moon. And I was like, oh my God, I had forgotten that the moon exists. Complex numbers are so fascinating. Okay, let's move on. So let's start with you probably all know the very basics, I'm just gonna go through them very quickly. just to kind of set notation, I guess. They used to have presets in which all three blackboards would move at the same time. I don't know why that's not working today. Probably I should go to that side because it's not covering. So a complex number is essentially, one way of looking at it is to think of it as an ordered pair of real numbers, A and B. So is a complex number, it's defined like this, where it's subject to the condition that I squared is minus 1. And then you can easily verify that two complex numbers can also be written in this form. And if you multiply two complex numbers, that can also be written in this form. And not only that, you can also, if you divide a complex number by another one, that can also be written in that form. So I'm just going to look at this. It introduces a technique called rationalization. So if Z1 is A1 plus IB1 and Z2 is A2 plus IB2, then the technique of rationalization is that you multiply this thing by 1, and 1 is nothing but A2 minus B2. So we take this thing, and when we flip the sign of the imaginary unit in a complex number, that's known as conjugation. So we divide that by the same number, and then what we get is that this thing, if you just do the algebra, you get a1, a2 plus b1, b2 divided by a2 squared, b2 squared plus I, b1, a1 minus b2, a1 by a2 squared plus b2 squared, right? So this, yes, you're right, yes. Somebody's awake. Okay, so as you can see, this is a real number and this is a real number, so we can, even the division of two complex numbers, it forms a closed set under all these operations. And that's why, you know, the set of complex numbers is known as a division algebra. Apparently there are only four, I'm not a mathematician, but I've heard that there are only four division algebras: real numbers, complex numbers, quaternions, and octonions. And so real numbers are ordered. So given two real numbers, you can always say which one is bigger. Complex numbers are not ordered. Two complex numbers, as we shall see, can have the same magnitude, but they are commutative and associative. Quaternions are not commutative, but they're associative. And octonions, they're not ordered, they're not associative, they're not commutative, you know, they're just a bunch of anarchists. And so complex conjugation is, as I said, you know, it's the operation by which you, so if Z1 is a number, so Z A plus IB, then its complex conjugate, which is Z bar, some people also use the notation Z star, is A minus IB. And if you do complex conjugation twice, it basically comes back to the same thing. And then complex conjugation distributes over addition and multiplication. So these are all very easy to prove and obvious, almost. Every few years, it happens to me that I forget how to add, and I have to teach myself again. And then the most important thing about complex conjugation, it allows you to introduce the modulus of a complex number as a positive square root of this. And if you express them in terms of their real and imaginary part, this thing. So for example, as I was saying before, if I take two complex numbers which are distinct, for example, these two complex numbers, they're not the same complex number because their real parts are different, although the imaginary part is the same, but they have the same modulus, right? So you know, both their modulus is square root of 2. So the modulus is a measure of length of the complex number. This just shows that the set of complex numbers is not an ordered set. There can be there are lots of elements of complex numbers, you know, which have the same modulus. I think this is known. You know, writing the complex numbers in this form immediately kind of suggests, let's see if the presets work here. Okay, what do I want? I want the front to go up. Yes. Almost worked. So this is I was building up to the notion of the Argand plane. So you can take a complex number, and its real part, you can think of it as the real part of a vector. So this is the real of z, and this as the imaginary of z. So 1 is somewhere here, I is here, and then this is our complex number a. Then this length is z, a. This length is a, and then this length is b. So when we say the imaginary part of a complex number, we mean b. When we mean the real part, it's a. The imaginary part of a complex number is a real number, right? Because b is a real number. So this is known as the Argand vessel plane, named after the guys who discovered slash invented it. When I was in school, we used to call it the complex plane. But I guess since then, people have discovered who actually. When I first read Roger Penrose's book, The Empire's New Mind, he calls it the Argand plane. But in his later books, he calls it the Argand vessel plane. So historical research. So the Argand vessel plane is extremely important because it kind of unlocks the geometry. It kind of, it's a setting for the geometrical interpretation of complex numbers. So for example, we can think of the addition of two complex numbers now as kind of the vector addition. So, because we can think of this complex number z as a vector as in something that has both direction and magnitude, which is not a very nice definition. So these two vectors, so if you have two complex numbers, the addition has the obvious interpretation of vector addition. What is less obvious is what's the geometric interpretation of the multiplication of two complex numbers. And it turns out that the interpretation of that is that you take one of the complex numbers, z1, and you make a triangle going from 0, 1, and say z1. And then that triangle and the triangle which is formed by 0 and say z2, and z1 and z2, so it goes somewhere like that. So these two triangles are similar triangles. That's the interpretation of the multiplication of complex numbers. And we'll soon see why this is so. So you can, to see that, what I would do is that I would start with the following observation is that, if you take 1 and you multiply it with I, you get I, of course. So multiplication with I, you can think of it as an operation of rotating that number by 90 degrees in the counterclockwise fashion. And this kind of, obviously begs the question is that, can you actually rotate by an arbitrary angle, theta? And actually, you can. But to see that, we need to go over to the polar coordinates. And the polar coordinates is really, really very powerful. It unlocks a lot of the, beautiful geometry of complex numbers. So basically, if I write A as R sine of theta and B as R What am I saying? Cosine. And B as R sine of theta. So you have some number. So this is R and this is theta. Then Z can be written as, now if I use the fact that, you know, cosine and if you use the sine and cosine, the Taylor expansion of sine and cosine, and use the fact that I squared is minus 1, then of course, as you all know, we get to this expression, which is the famous Euler's formula. And do you guys know the story of Euler and Catherine the Great? Okay, so Euler was, you know, mathematicians and academics have always been, you know, they had to find patrons, right? Because they're not good at earning money themselves. So Euler was the court mathematician of Catherine the Great, you know. And he was, I think Denis Diderot was coming to Russia. And Denis Diderot had the reputation of being an atheist, you know. And so Catherine the Great, you know, she asked Euler to kind of, you know, insult this, him in some way. So so Euler said that, you know, e to the power I pi is minus 1, therefore God exists. So this story might be completely apocryphal, but you know, but I think it's funny. Right, so now we know the answer to our question, how do you rotate a complex number by an arbitrary angle? How do you rotate Z by, say, the angle theta? How do you do it? I can't hear you. Right, you multiply by e to the power I of theta. And now we can see why, you know, oops, my God. Why, you know, we can see the reason for the geometric interpretation of the multiplication, because what we're doing when we're multiplying Z1 by Z2 is that 0, of course, remains 0. 1 is rotated to Z2, and it's also scaled at the same time, because Z2 has a modulus, so this is the modulus. So this rotates it along Z2, and R2 rescales it, 1 into Z2. And similarly, Z1 is rotated to Z1 times Z2 and rescaled. And because although you're rescaling everything by the same amount, and you're rotating everything by the same angle, and that's why you get two similar triangles, right? So the Euler formula kind of is, you know, defined in a domain where theta is, takes the value between 0 and 2 pi. But if you extend the domain of theta to, say, the real line, then the Euler formula tells you that, you know, that z e to the power I theta becomes a periodic function, right? Because it's made out of sines and cosines. So, so allowing for that, we can write z given a complex number, we can write it as e to the power I theta. I'm going to put a p here, and I'm going to tell you why. So before I say that, you know, This thing, theta, is called the argument of z, and it's often written as like this. So this is the argument of z. And so what theta, so what I'm trying to say is that this, for a given value of z, there are many, many thetas. So the argument is a multivalued object. It's a multivalued function. And by convention, the value of theta, which gives you that z, which is in the region between 0 and 2 pi, that value of theta is called the principal argument, principal value of the argument. And sometimes, so that's why the p is there. And sometimes the principal value is written by a big A, whereas any argument is written by small a. So where n takes, n is an integer. So this is an extremely important observation that we are going to build upon. So for example, you know, I is e to the power 2 pi by 2. Or you can do a 360 rotation, which is 5 pi by 2, right? So this is for n equals to 0. This is n equals to 1, then n equals to 2, blah, 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 blah. And you can also take values of n going in the negative integers, right? So given, oh my God, I have to rush now. So given that you can, you know, this Euler formula, it's very easy to prove the de Moivre, de Moivre. We have French speakers, right? Louder, please. De Moivre, I can't do the French R. Anyway, so de Moivre's theorem is for an integer n, so this becomes a triviality, right? So now, you know, we come to the something that I alluded to earlier, is that the root of, you know, the root of polynomial equations. But at the heart of it is finding the nth root of complex numbers. So basically solving, so if I give you a complex number omega, and I ask you to find the nth root of this of this complex numbers. That means you find the z's which satisfy this equation. So to do this, let's write omega as a, in the Euler form, in the polar coordinates. Where k now is an integer. And then z is, can't see. Then z is 1 over r, you know, so this is a real number, so, and then I theta p by 2, so not 2, n, plus 2 pi k by n, right? So we have, and now, so, so you can see now that for k going from 0, 1, 0 to, say, n minus 1, we have n different complex numbers here. And graphically, what is happening is that we have a circle whose radius is r over 1 over n. And for values of k 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, dot, dot, n minus 1, we get points on the circle, and the angle that is separating these, every one of these points is 2 pi n. So these points are the roots of that complex number omega. So for example, if I ask you what is the roots of unity, then the answer is that it's 1, and then this is e to the power 2 pi by 3, and this is e to the power, there's an I here, 4 pi I by 3. So they're essentially, oh God, it's a horrible circle. They're on a circle, and they're all separated by 120 degrees. Okay. And then, you know, it just, you know, everything becomes a lot more transparent. Okay. Any questions so far? You guys all know this, right? But, you know, just in the case, you know, it's like you have to build up, you know, some, you know, you think you know something, and then you say, oh, how did that come about? So the argument of a complex number is an example of a multivalued function. Now, we can also introduce the idea of logarithm of complex numbers. And I'm going to bring down that one. I hate these erasers. There we go. So I promise that this class will get more interesting in a few minutes. So, okay, so we have some complex number z, and it's, this is what I'm using, r, and r is the modulus of z, right? Is that clear to everyone? Sorry, I haven't finished writing this. So as we know, the definition of a log, we extend the definition that we had for real numbers, which would be and thus we see that the log of a complex number is also a multi-valued function, right? So I'm using scare quotes, because I guess functions are not supposed to be multivalued because they're nice objects, but you know, but we are going to make them nice functions very by doing some surgeries. But the I think that it's better to look at another multivalued function, which we actually have secretly already. So let's so for example, square root of z. Now, so square root of z is basically going to give you square root of the modulus of z, which is r, and e to the power I theta by 2, which we can also write as right. So now let's see what happens, because I said that this is a double valued function. Let's see that how that works. So suppose you're on the complex plane and you draw a little circle. It doesn't have to be a circle, but there's just a closed loop that goes around the origin. So this circle has some constant radius. So now you start from here and you go around. Right. So what changes in this expression? The modulus does not change. It's only theta that changes, right? So at the beginning of our journey, theta is 0. At the end of our journey, what is theta? Theta is 2 pi. So e to the power I 2 pi by 2 is e to the power I pi, which is minus 1. Right? So that means that as you go around on the complex plane, you come back to the same point on the complex plane, your function doesn't come back to the same value. So you can also express the same fact by saying that, well, theta p only goes from 0 to 2 pi, but as we come back, we have to choose the value of k to 1. It was 0 initially and then 1. So this, we can actually make this function a single valued function if we extend the domain on which this is defined. And this is, so before we get into that, any point around which a function has this property of not being single valued is called a branch point. So here the branch point is z equals to 0. So if you had gone around a circle around here, you can show that you actually, so what would you do? You have this angle theta and this angle theta 2. So you actually would go, or you know, this would change some in some way, but theta would go between theta 1 and theta 2, right? But it will never, and then come back. So you will not. So going around the circuit, you will not pick up a minus sign. So. And you know, I took for convenience, I took the modulus of this complex numbers to be a constant, so that I drew a circle. But you can actually, like, you know, just by adding these two concepts together, you can see that this didn't have to be a circle. All it had to do is to basically go around the origin once, right? Because this thing, you can do it here, right? You can take a small circle here. And then, so any loop which goes around the origin will give you a minus sign. Yes?
What about if you take the square root of z plus 1 or anything like that?
Right.
The
then
argument changes as going around minus 1? Or
yes, plus 1.
Right.
Z minus 1 or
is it? Z plus 1.
Oh, then minus 1. That's tomorrow's tutorial will be about that, amongst other things. Okay. So how do we actually make this into a nice, function? And the way to do this is to actually, it's a procedure known as, erase that. Yeah, I sometimes want, oh, sorry. See, safety features. So, so to make this into a well-defined function, what we do is that we take two copies of the complex plane. So we take this, we take two copies of the complex plane. And what we do is that as I go around, as we go around the first complex plane, I introduce what I call a branch cut on the positive real axis. So this is a branch cut. So what does it mean? What it means is that as I go towards this branch cut in this direction, I identify this, you know, this thing with the same real line on this second complex plane. So as I hit this, this purple line, I think of the function as taking its value in another complex plane. So emerging on this complex plane along this branch cut. And as it goes around, then it hits this yellow line. Which I then identify, because I've identified, right, so it then emerges through this yellow line over here. It's a little bit like a, sorry? No, not many worlds, because they're, you know, you're actually sewing together these two things. It's a little bit like a car park, where you're going around, but except that in the car park when you reach the top floor, if you go another round, you come back to the bottom floor. You know, if you had a car park in space and you take the car park and expand it like an accordion. And you can just join it like that, right? Or the bottom floor and the top floor. You know, think of a car park that you can just, deformable, Then that's basically it.
Is there some kind of convention why you chose this part of the
real? No, that's a very good question. It turns out that there is a branch point at infinity. And the way to see that is that we took this function, but let's call omega a new variable, complex variable, which is 1 over omega. In terms of the new variable, this is our function, right? So we can actually, that's an amazing thing about complex numbers analysis, is that we can actually, the point at infinity is actually a real point. So the behavior of a function at infinity can be examined by making this transformation and asking how does this, this function behave at omega equals to zero. And so you basically have something like, So now you can, write that r prime of minus omega e to the power minus I theta by 2, right? So if you go around omega equals to 0, you know, in a small circle, so omega is not exactly 0, but it's close to 0, the same thing happens. So that means that at omega equals to 0, which is z equals to infinity, there's another branch point. So if you do the surgery over here, you actually have to do the surgery over there. And all that you have to do is to actually, this branch, so these cuts are called branch cuts. So the branch cut from one branch point will emanate, and it'll go all the way up to infinity and join up with the other branch point. But so this is a complete convention how I've done it. It could have done something like this and gone off to infinity, right?
So,
yes.
I do the surgeries on these two sheets, and I kind of glue them together, and now my function is univalued.
Right.
Right. So in the case I have, for example, a function that it's four-valued, I would need four sheets.
Right. So the geometry can get very hairy of this. These are called Riemann surfaces. Also, I think there's a degeneracy in the name. Those things are also called Riemann surfaces. But these are also called Riemann surfaces. I guess, you know, there was only one Riemann and both are surfaces. But that's a very good question. You can get lots of very complicated geometry of Riemann surfaces. And, and I'll give you some references for some. There's actually a paper which argues that the quantization condition of energies in quantum mechanics is actually due to the fact that we measure energy in real numbers. It's actually continuous. If you let energy be a complex quantity, and then you actually get a very rich structure on the energy plane. And we only get this discretization because we are looking at a real section of this energy function.
And the other thing is that this branch point at infinity can be seen in the Riemann sphere.
Right, which is another object of our tomorrow's tutorial. So tomorrow's tutorial, we'll see that you can actually take a complex plane and map it into a sphere. And this is just a stereographic projection. So when I was a kid, I used to look at maps, and I would be like always confused. Why are the countries always so deformed? You know, why is everything so deformed? Like, if the world map, you know, there will be some deformation, right? And that's due to the fact, as you know, you're taking a sphere and projecting it onto a two-dimensional surface, right? And you can go the other way around, and all the points at infinity, this is known as stereographic projection, get mapped to a point at the North Pole or the South Pole, depending on your projection. And the infinity is just not a special point. It's just a point, you know, on that sphere, and that sphere is known as the Riemann sphere. And you know, tomorrow's tutorial, we're going to work on the Riemann sphere. So before we, you know, break, we end today's lecture. Oh, I've got a nice picture. So sorry, I misspoke when I said that it's like a car park. It's a little bit more subtle than the car park, because the sheet that goes up and the sheet that goes down, they intersect. They intersect because I'm trying to draw them in three dimensions. It's a bit like the Klein bottle. You know, you can only imagine it in a four-dimensional. In four dimensions, they could have avoided each other, right? Like the Klein bottle, you know, is a two-dimensional surface. You can't really embed it in three dimensions. You need four dimensions, right? So those guys who are selling the Klein bottle online, they're lying to you. Okay, so I have, so looking at how many, you know, like the branch point of the log function is again the origin, right? So, and the, well, not the origin, sorry. What I want to say is that the logarithm is, so here, you know, if we went around twice in a loop, we came back to the same value, right? But here, we see that we don't come back to the same value, right? As we go around the loop, this just becomes bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, this thing. Or if you go back the other way, it becomes smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, right? So that shows that it's an infinite valued. If you want to make that into a nice function, the Riemann surface that you have to introduce is an infinitely sheeted Riemann surface. And you can also show that there's actually the point at infinity is also infinitely sheeted. So, and yes?
So let's say I'm working in, I don't know, some physical problem where I encounter the logarithm of a complex number. What makes me choose one branch instead of the other?
That's a very important question, but very important, yeah. So in a lot of physical applications, you actually have to choose, it'll depend on the context. I'll try to think of some problems, and I think I just came across some problems in a book the other day. So, you know, but yeah, in physical problems, you usually have to choose, you know, one. But Carl Bender, who used to teach a mathematical methods course here, you know, he wrote a paper on how the energy levels of an harmonic oscillator have this very, very exotic structure in terms of infinite number of complex, you know, of Riemann surfaces. Well, infinitely sheeted Riemann surfaces. So he would say that no, you know, you have to take those equations seriously, which he does. He's taken those equations seriously. What they mean physically, we don't know. Like, I've asked him, and he said, well, maybe it has something to do with quantum field theory at a deeper level, but no, that's a very good question. I don't have a very good answer. Probably is a very context independent question. I'll look into that. Yeah. So the other thing that I want to leave you with is I just mentioned the Moivre theorem, where I took the integer to be some power n. I took the power to be some integer n. So what if you took that power to be an arbitrary, say, real number? What would go wrong? Can you still have de Moivre's theorem? Or what qualification would you have to do? Can somebody tell me or just tell their thoughts about it? If you know the answer, don't say anything. Yes?
Is it like the same thing as trying to find the roots of something exponentiated to some like square root of 2?
Right. So suppose you take the power to be some fractional number, right? Then e to the power I theta times that thing will be a multiple valued, you know, object. Because as we saw the square, you know, the when we found the roots of unity, you know, that, you know, we when we inverted the equation, it was a multiple valued equation, right? And the same will happen on the left-hand side. But on the right-hand side of de Moivre's theorem, we have very specific addition of cosine and sine with no powers on them, and they are single-valued, right? So what will happen? So the qualification that we have to make about de Moivre's theorem is that the right-hand side is one of the values of the left-hand side, but the left-hand side has more, you know, solutions. So that's why de Moivre's theorem is, as a theorem, it's only valid for integers, right? So, okay, I've run out of things to say, but we still have 5 minutes. So if you guys want to ask more questions, yes, Jason.
Is there like a theorem about the number of branch points given the function?
Oh, I get that question every year. I have no idea. Maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't. I would, like, given a function, you want to see what are the branch points. I think it's a very non-trivial question. You know, there is no like. Maybe and if somebody knows here. As far as I know from my physical intuition, from what I've seen in physics, application of this in physics, again, going back to Carl Bender's paper, on the enharmonic oscillator. He had to do a numerical analysis on the complex plane to find all the branch cuts.
I guess a related question is, like, is there a more formal definition of a branch point as opposed to just like trying to integrate things? Because, like, I guess the question is, how would you find them besides guess and check?
Oh, right. Well, you go around a small loop, and if you come back to the same point, then it's not a branch point. So you go and do that for every point on your complex plane, and you're good. that would be my answer, but what you're asking is that if I give you a function, you put it into some machine, does it spit out? I don't know the answer to that. I don't think so, but
so this loop can be arbitrarily defined.
The loop can be deformed, but but you can't cross. If you cross a branch point, I don't think I follow exactly.
It can be any form.
Loop,
as long as it doesn't cross over.
Yeah, as long as it hasn't gone around the origin, So you're good to take small loops. Just carry a small loop in your pocket. Just test every point. But usually when you see the function, you can tell. Like, that was one of the questions in yesterday's test quiz, is that, what are the branch points, And you could usually, for simple function, you can usually tell. For complex things, so first Andreas and then Nima.
Is there any way, or is there a relation, if I can find a branch point at infinity, then I still have a branch point at zero or anything like that?
No, not necessarily. The thing is that the branch points have to appear in such a way that they always have to. Usually, a lot of time, the branch points, if you have a branch point on a finite part of the complex plane, usually there is one on the infinity. But it doesn't have to be in principle. So for example, if you take, say, I think one of the...
So my question is for the following is, a branch point can be identified with a singularity by making that variable change.
You're saying that should a branch point always have a singularity? No.
Not necessarily.
No, I don't think so.
I can take, for example, square root of z plus 1 or anything like that. And
Let me go back to the example that we did yesterday and what was it? It was z squared minus 1
square root,
right? So here the branch, was it plus 1? Plus 1, yeah. So here the branch points are plus I minus I on the finite part of the complex plane, right? But there are branch points also in the infinity. But suppose you take the value of z to be very, very large. Then this function looks like z. So that means that if you draw a large circle around the origin, right, you come back to the same value. If from the point of view of a large circle, you don't see a branch point. But if you draw a small circle around these points, then you do see branch points. Therefore, the branch cut has to be between these two guys. Or it can be like this, but they have to join up, right? Whereas in that case, the branch cut went from the origin all the way to infinity. Here, there will be another branch cut at infinity between the two points there.
My question was exactly this. So I don't see, you can take branch cuts one from each point to infinity, which is a single point, so I guess what would be wrong with saying that branch cuts go to infinity? You'd get the exact same results. If you have a big circle, you go through two branch cuts, so you come back to the same place. If you only go over one of them, you get the negative sign, which is what you would expect. So wouldn't that also be the correct answer?
So
the branch cuts going from I to infinity and minus I to infinity. And as a matter of fact, like you said, if you do the stereographic projection, point at infinity is a common point between the points at any infinity is
So here the branch points are the points at infinity. The point at infinity is not a branch point. There will be points near that point.
It's not. Yeah. So what I'm saying is, imagine a path from minus I to I, except it goes to infinity. Which, if I was to draw it on a regular.
Yeah, but then your circle will cross that branch cut twice, and that will actually undo the minus sign that you did by crossing it once. So there's something very topological about it. So can I just, sorry, Jason, I'll come back to you. So what Nima is saying is that I do this, so that my big circle will actually cross the branch cuts, right? That's what you're saying. But you see, you're going around twice. So you know, when you if you start with this point, you come around and you're actually, you know, going to a different branch, and then you're coming back to the same branch, so you will actually not get that minus sign.
Which is what you would want. No, you're mixing them up. The point of a branch cut is so that you want to uniquely define the two parts. And so you extend from I outward and minus I outward.
So you know, your test is that, you know, can I take a big circle and go around the circle and then get a minus one? So you say, okay, what if I do this? So you want to come like this, okay. But you can do this, right? Then you will get a minus because you're only going around one point. But if you go around both, then you will get a minus sign. Jason?
So I'm kind of confused why plus and minus infinity aren't branch points. I see why the argument you gave that it's approximately z, but if you try to apply the argument, I guess so, I'm not making any sense right now. Like, so for the function omega equals 1 over z, you use the, I guess you implied that branch points stay the same under function composition. And if you try to use the same argument to try to find the branch points of the more complicated function, then you would get the plus or minus or infinity or branch points.
So your first thing was that branch points stay the same under function composition. So no, you see, here there were two branch points, one at z equals to 0 and one at z equals to infinity. And the one see the one at z equals to infinity, it's good to make this variable transformation. And then, you know, and then write it as in this form. So there are two branch points here.
No, I guess we can talk about this more, but it seems like that the arguments you used in like the first example and the second example, you could apply it the other way and get different results than what we said.
Can you, for example, argue that?
Can we sort of say something like omega equals 1 over z, and then we have 1 over z squared, 1 over omega squared plus, that's why if you do the same thing, you'll end up with the one as the z goes to infinity, because the one omega squared goes to 0, but you end up with the one as you take the limit. So that part disappears. In the case when you're taking the variable transformation omega equal to 1 over z, when you take the limit of z going to infinity, the 1 over, you end up with basically 0, right? But in the other case, if you take omega equal to 1 over z, you apply the same coordinate transformation, there's a 1 still there.
Yeah, there's 1 there.
Not the same, but like another coordinate transformation. I guess maybe the problem
is that's the simplest one.
So if the thing is you want to map probably two points to one point. Is that what you're trying to do? You want to come up with a variable transformation? Or?
Actually, I think I see the problem now with the variable transformation.
Okay, we are out of time. You probably want a break before Anna teaches you all about algebra. Okay, but tomorrow there'll be a tutorial in the afternoon, okay? Thank you. Oh, these notes, I put them on the wiki.
Yep.
So you can actually